welcome everybody. I know we've got a number of institutions from around the country who've joined us today, and I certainly have to say I'm in Washington, D.C., and it's a much nicer day here than it was when we did the one of these a month ago when the blizzard was coming down in full fury. So I hope that some of you are also enjoying the beginnings of spring wherever you may be. I've got a few things I wanted to just chat about a little bit before opening this up for questions, but we should have plenty of time for that, and I hope that there's some good ones. One of the things I wanted to do was just say a couple of words about the upcoming CNI meeting scheduled for mid-April in Baltimore. We've got all of the breakouts finalized now, and those should all be up with a schedule certainly by early next week, perhaps a little sooner. I talked about the opening and closing plenaries on the last call, the opening plenary being a panel on implementation issues involved in either funder or institutional open access mandates, and the closing plenary being a talk by Liz Lyon, building on the report that she did late last year on what she was calling science at web scale, which deals with a lot of issues around open science, citizen science, and related things. We've got a tremendous number of breakouts for this session, for this meeting. Actually, looks like we'll have about 38 breakouts, believe it or not, which is just an amazing amount of material, and I'm not going to take you through all of them, but I do just want to highlight a few that are coming up that I think should be really interesting. I'm actually going to do lead a discussion about the implications of personal archiving for memory organizations, and I'll come back to that in a minute because it builds on a meeting that I was at that I want to say a few words about that took place in mid-February. But just to sample a few of the other breakouts that we've got coming, we've got a session dealing with common search systems across museums and library collections. We've got a session that's dealing with a system called Vivo that originally came out of Cornell. It's really sort of a social networking tool for scientists and scholars, and there's been a large grant that, if memory serves, is being led by the University of Florida, but involves four or five institutions, which is trying to take this system beyond an institutional to a national system. And it's really quite an interesting and sophisticated system that I saw a demo of about a year ago when I was up at Cornell, which does some very interesting linking to scientific publications and interest profiles. We've got several sessions that deal in various aspects of the relationships between data sets and journal articles, looking at how one might cite data sets, some of the best practices that are emerging about treating them as supplemental materials. I think that those should be quite timely. We've got Diane Hartley coming from the University of California at Berkeley to talk about the major study, which I believe I mentioned on an earlier call, that the Center for the Study of Higher Education there did with Mellon funding, looking at the choices that faculty make about scholarly communication, and specifically how the sort of beliefs about the the tenure and promotion system affect that? It's a massive study, about 700 pages, and I did put a pointer out to CNI Announce when that came out, so you can find it in the archives there. But she'll boil that down, and I imagine there'll be some lively discussion following that on. One that I'm really eager to see is presentation out of Emory on the architectural reconstruction of some of the temples at Knossos in Crete. This kind of follows on or connects to some of the kinds of work that Bernie Frischer described at our last meeting about using technology to do these architectural reconstructions, and I think that should be really interesting. There's a ton of additional ones. The Ithaca folks are going to release the next cycle in this set of longitudinal studies that they've been doing, I believe, since around 2002 or 3, on faculty attitudes towards electronic resources and electronic publishing. We've got also some stuff on interoperable annotation, kind of building on the work that that Herbert von de Sample had talked about. But this talk will come from folks at MIF, Center for Humanities at Maryland, and from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason. So this will be a sort of an applications look at some of those issues. And, you know, I've only mentioned here about 8 or 9 sessions out of, 38. So that gives you kind of a flavor of some of the range of the highlights. Joan Lippincott is also going to lead a discussion about learning commons and what's working. She's got two speakers, one from the University of Colorado and one from the University of Pennsylvania, who will be sharing experiences and views on that. And I think that should be quite a lively conversation. And I guess one other I just wanted to mention that will be, I think, quite interesting is a report by Howard Besser and some of his colleagues on where the video preservation, the television's preservation strand of NDIP stands at this point. There was a very large-scale collaboration involving Channel 13 in New York City and PBS and other folks really trying to put a real strategy in place for handling the preservation of public broadcasting materials at some scale. And that's been underway, I guess, for about 4 years now. So I'll be very interested to hear how that's been developing. So those are a few highlights I just wanted to share out on the meeting as it's shaping up. I will be putting out the usual roadmap to the announcement list probably the last week of March or thereabouts, maybe a little sooner, but that's where we are on that. I want to just mention very briefly two meetings that I was at in the last week. One was the founding meeting for something called the Consortium for Open Access Repositories. This is a group that is just coming into being, largely driven by national-based developments in Europe, like the DRIVER program in the Netherlands, and some of the national strategy approaches that have been taken in the UK through the JISC or in France. basically are getting to the point there where they're getting real interested in how we're going to get effective interoperation between national repository systems and between subject and institutional repositories. And so a group, as I say, largely driven by the repository funders in many of the European nations, but also with representation from Japan, from China, from Canada, and a few other places, decided to get together and start looking at a program of work. A lot of it emphasizes standards and best practices, and frankly, there's still a bit of disagreement about exactly what the scope of the core project should be, and in particular, whether they should host any operational services themselves. But I thought that it was important that we at least have an ear in and a voice in some of these discussions, particularly in the U.S. And since there really is no organized, funding stream that's putting a national repository system in place, after consulting with our steering committee and talking with colleagues at ARL and Spark and other places, we reached the conclusion that at least for right now, it was probably most effective to have CNI serve as a conduit to and from the work of this organization. There were a lot of draft documents on the table at the meeting, and they're going to be redrafted in most cases, I think, as the result of the meeting. And as some of that material becomes more mature and more settled, I will share it out through various ways and probably talk with it again. But I thought that people might at least be interested to know that these conversations are taking place. The other meeting I just want to mention in passing that I caught at least a piece of was the WebWise conference that the Institute for Museum and Library Studies puts on every year. This was actually the 10th year they've done this, which is amazing. And it's quite a nice showcase for a lot of the work that IMLS has funded, and particularly for some of the digitization efforts that span museums, libraries, and archives, rather than sitting just in one of those three kind of stovepipes. The session there that I would say probably most grabbed my attention was a discussion of interaction around collections. And this is an area that I've been interested in for a long time, and we've probably talked about here or in the CNI meetings in connection with activities like the contribution of materials to Flickr Commons by various kinds of cultural heritage organizations, and how that subsequent set of interactions with the public are managed. But a really interesting set of discussions took place there among the panelists that really started to get to questions like, how far are various kinds of cultural memory organizations willing to go in engaging and owning that dialogue, and to what extent do they really want to keep a distance from it? And that, you know, certainly to me seems to be an increasingly real and pressing question. I don't know that there's a single answer to it. It really, I think, is perhaps going to become one of the defining elements in the character, in fact, of cultural heritage organizations going forward. But I did think that was a particularly lively discussion. In the past, they have taken video of the WebWise meetings and made them available. And I believe they're going to do it this time. Last I looked, there wasn't anything up on their website about it. But some of you might enjoy seeing that the video of that segment when and if they make it available. And I'll try and remember to put an announcement out to CNI announce on that. I'll mention one other thing, and then I want to talk a little bit about this business of personal archiving that I alluded to earlier. So before I go there, I want to mention a couple of things that are happening in the area of scientific collections. This seems to be a topic that is very much in the air, and I was interested to learn that, backing up a minute, back in 2008, there was actually a survey form going around out of the National Science Foundation asking institutions of higher education and some other organizations as well about their holdings of scientific collections. Now, just to scope that a bit, these are specimen collections, things like, you know, botanical collections, stuffed birds, microbes, fossils, minerals. There are also collections that, in some cases, deal with social science material, surveys and things. And NSF was kind of looking at what was out there and what it was being used for. I think there was a recognition that this was an important part of the infrastructure for science, and they wanted to kind of get a better handle on the scope of it. So they did this survey in 2008, and they actually published in mid-2009 a document that I hadn't seen until like a week ago called the NSF Scientific Collections Survey. And I will put a URL for this out to CNI Announce very shortly. But it's a hugely interesting document that, among other things, suggests that about half of the collections that they surveyed are in the biological area, about a quarter in minerals, geology, and related things, and then others scattered around in different areas, although social sciences was a significant chunk as well. And it talked a bit about the state of these collections, the growth of them, who was using them. It's really a pretty interesting document. And among other things, it really, I think, for me, put some quantitative support to the extent to which universities actually house museums or museum-like collections that support science, as opposed to, you know, your sort of more typical, perhaps, mental picture of Ivy League universities with university art museums. They looked at the connection between these collections and universities, and about two-thirds of the collections they identified were actually affiliated with universities, whereas about a third were freestanding or, you know, attached to private not-for-profits like standalone museums of natural history or things of that nature. So I found this to be quite interesting. And then From here, there seems to be a whole flurry of activity now going on in thinking about national strategies for digitizing some of these biological collections, particularly things like the botanical collections of type specimens. There was a meeting that was held in St. Louis about 10 days ago, bringing together a large number of people from herbaria around the U.S. to look at the potential of drawing up a program to build a sort of a virtual U.S. herbarium by aggregating these type samples. So this is some of the discussion that seems to be triggering off this this inventory of scientific collections. And I think this is a development that bears watching because, again, it speaks to this confluence of museums, archives, and libraries and the expertises that they hold in directly in support of scholarly research in the digital world. I think it's a fascinating kind of example of those developments. So the last thing I wanted to say a few words about before opening things up for some questions and comments is this business of personal archiving. There have been a number of studies, both by individual researchers and larger scale studies, the most notable perhaps being the Digital Lives Program that was funded by the Arts and Humanities Funding Council and JISC in the UK and based at the British Library. That was about a 2 or 3 year effort to look at a whole lot of things, including personal behavior in managing various kinds of digital artifacts at a personal level. You know, do you back things up? How do you back things up? What are your expectations about the persistence of your digital photos or music you might have acquired in digital form? Do you keep a diary in digital form? If you're an author, you know, do you keep drafts and things like that? And part of what was driving their concern was, what does this mean to the future of special collections and the future of a number of scholarly activities like the writing of biography and history that make such critical use of these personal materials? There have also been a number of very, very good studies by individual scholars, notably I'd highlight some of Kathy Marshall's work from Microsoft Research, Neil Beegery's work of a couple of years ago in the UK, and there are some others. So at this point, and particularly with the Digital Lives work, which is just starting now to put out its sort of synthetic summary documents of all the work that's been happening under that umbrella, and I actually put out a pointer to CNI announce about some of that work a couple of weeks ago. We have a pretty good set of what I characterize as largely descriptive studies about what people are starting to do and what they believe. What we don't really have is a good understanding of what this means or what this might mean for the behavior of museums, archives, special collections, and similar organizations going forward, and you know what the implications of these changes are. Jeff Dubois, who works a lot with people like Brister Kahle at the Internet Archive, pulled together a wonderful meeting out in San Francisco in mid-February, looking at some of these developments, and some of the material from that meeting is now up on the web. But one of the things that we really tried to focus on a bit in that meeting was this question of what does this mean for cultural memory organizations? How should strategies change? How does this connect with practices in acquisitions, for example, or in collection building? Are we moving into a period where these institutions need to start thinking about building up relationships earlier with people who they identify as being the creators of personal histories that are going to be interesting for the long-term record in digital form? What sorts of things go into that record? How do you kind of rebalance a lot of the understandings and even underneath that, the trust around acquiring collections that intermix very personal material with material that might be more archival in nature and that the creator or the owner might be more willing to share. When you start dealing in things like, enormous email archives, it seems like that has nobody's liable to go through their message by message, but people may be willing to trust archivists to ensure that these are used in some kind of an appropriate way going forward. There are lots of really interesting questions here, and we looked at them a bit in the meeting in San Francisco, but I'm increasingly feeling that there is some need to capture at least some of the best thinking. I don't even want to use terms like best practices yet, but best thinking of some of the cultural memory organizations who are starting to really engage these problems very directly and to get a broader discussion going on around that topic. So that's what I'm hoping to do in the breakout discussion that I'm going to be leading at the spring CNI meeting, building very directly off the work of that San Francisco conference in February. And I'd certainly invite all of you who have an interest in this to take a look at the very good set of notes that were developed from that San Francisco meeting. I think that the collection of issues here is really extraordinarily rich and is one that is going to have some pretty substantial long-term implications. The choices we make here may turn out to be rather important going forward. So those are some of the developments over the last 3 or 4 weeks that have been engaging my attention and that I wanted to spend a few minutes sharing and commenting on. I think that what I'd like to do now before burning up any more time, though, is to really open us up for comments and questions from the group. So I'll pass this back to our moderator to manage the flow of questions in.
Thank you. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Questions will be taken in the order they were received. If you are using a speakerphone, we ask that while posting your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. If at any time your question has been answered, you can remove yourself from the queue by pressing 1. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Please hold while we poll for questions. Thank you. And our first question comes from Wendy Gogel of Harvard. Please state your question.
Okay, actually it's Randy Stern over here with Wendy Gogel at Harvard. The question is about Cliff's comment about personal archiving and archiving things such as email. One of the questions we've been struggling with is the question of when email contains confidential information, and I'm wondering what Cliff's opinion is of how that impacts repository strategies, storage strategies, metadata access, etc. And it seems to change the nature of a lot of library information when there's confidential information contained in that data.
Actually, particularly because many of the archivists that are involved in the project here certainly don't think that they're going to be in a position to look at individual emails.
Yeah, this is a really, really big problem, and it feels like one where we may ultimately have to renegotiate a few norms. It's very common to think about, you know, sort of traditional paper archives where you might have some kind of a finding aid or something, and you would a user of that collection, that material, might use the finding aid to page out some boxes or something, and there might be an understanding that someone would look through the material before they gave it to the user, or that the user, the researcher, might be willing to not use or not cite specific kinds of confidential material in there as a condition of using the archive. And, you know, some of that went to trust between the curator of the archive and the individual researcher and things like that. And you also see this really graphically when you deal with things like some of the material at the National Archives and Records Administration, where you may have not only confidential material but classified material intermixed in there, and they've for, you know, sort of collections that have only had limited processing, they think a great deal about models where somebody looks through the material before it's passed to the researcher, if a researcher wants one of these, you know, sort of unprocessed sets of material. When you think about digital collections, I mean, the first problem you get into is the very process of indexing it may reveal confidential information to the public if you just open the thing up for searching. The fact that you've extracted certain names or numbers or things like that out as index terms is itself problematic. I don't know exactly how we handle this. I don't know whether what we do is I suspect we do a lot of different things, all of which chip away at different aspects of the problem. One can imagine, for example, some kinds of trivial things like things that go redacting for strings that appear to be social security numbers or credit card numbers in large email files. So what you might actually wind up doing is taking one of these collections of email, and you actually have two versions of it. You have the redacted and unredacted, and the redacted one is shown by default to users, and if it looks like the redacting program has messed up, then one of the curators can go to the unredacted version to look and see what's really, you know, in there. But that only really works for pretty simple cases like identifiable numbers that are notable sore points. Beyond that, it gets really difficult. One can imagine there are some cases where one might be able to identify specific people that where the correspondence was likely to be highly sensitive, and to hold that out for manual intervention. But, you know, the name of the game here is to really minimize the manual intervention that's needed, and to try and take advantage of the fact that we can compute on these collections as a way of providing more access to them without, you know, the hope of human indexers and organizers really being able to process the collection in huge detail, because there's never enough money for that, and those people never quite arrive from so many collections. So those are, you know, at least a few thoughts on that. The other is that intake arrangements, deeds of gift and things like that, it seems like we want to be, wherever possible, computationally friendly. So I'm told, for example, that it's not uncommon to have a constraint placed on a collection of correspondence or papers that basically say they are closed until everybody mentioned in them is dead. That's sort of like copyright being life plus 75. It's sort of a viciously non-computable constraint that's going to be very expensive to test, whereas if you take something like, you know, 50 years from the date of deposit, that's a pretty easy thing to figure out algorithmically. One wonders if even in the kinds of cases we're talking about where you know, they say 10 years after everybody's dead or something, one couldn't use computational tools to figure out all the people who are mentioned in there, at least, as a means of simplifying that. But I think dates certain are going to be increasingly desirable for folks trying to curate material. I think that the other part of this probably is that it strongly suggests that certain kinds of material, like unprocessed collections of electronic mail, probably don't belong in institutional repositories, at least not in ones that are open to the public. They probably may very well need to live in more access-managed kinds of frameworks, just because of the character of electronic mail, that it seems to, you know, intermix very personal and very confidential and very public and very professionally oriented materials in this kind of intractable hodgepodge. I wish I had a better answer than that. Frankly, this is one of these areas where I think that we would really be helped by some focused research work, as well as a real effort to share experiences and early thinking among institutions who are struggling with this.
Thank you.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. In the meantime, Joan, do you have any questions on your end?
Yes. I would like to also remind our participants that before the next CNI conversations, you're welcome to email me with topics that you'd like Cliff to address the next time, or questions that you'd like to have posed during the time. And just to be clear, we will do Q&A for the rest of our time today, so feel free to keep your questions coming through star one to the moderator. But in the meantime, one question that came in was, what do you believe, Cliff, is the significance of cloud computing for libraries?
One of the things that's interesting to me about cloud computing, other than, it seems to be one of the big kind of hype areas of the year, being on every magazine cover and pundit's lips with the words, this will change everything irrevocably and this kind of thing, is the way libraries have gotten very focused on it. I've certainly heard university CIOs, for example, thinking hard about what are the ramifications of cloud computing, but there seems to be an idea abroad that it may also have some special meaning for libraries. I'm not going to try and answer this exhaustively at all, but maybe to kind of tease some pieces out. I mean, it seems to me that there are at least three or four different kinds of things that are going on. One is storage clouds, where basically the idea is we've got a variety of people like Amazon S3 who are offering basically storage that is network accessible and that is geographically replicated and managed by somebody else. So if you need storage that meets those criteria, you can go to one of these folks to get it. And that's certainly for all but the largest organizations a lot easier than managing the deployment of geographically widely dispersed storage by yourself. Clearly, it's very nice to have this as a utility service, and those who are dealing with archives of digital material that they want to assure the survival of, and that includes certainly all kinds of memory organizations, including libraries, are, I think, going to routinely be making use of this. One of the very interesting developments that I've been tracking is the work of DuraSpace, the merged organization that came out of Fedora and DSpace joining together on their DuraCloud program, where essentially what they're doing is setting themselves up as a broker for access to a whole portfolio of different storage clouds that have different redundancy and geographic dispersion properties, because in some cases you want, for example, some control over the geographic dispersion of data. You might want multiple diverse sites, but they might all, for example, need to be in the United States because of transborder data issues. Those kinds of things come into play, and they seem to be moving along quite rapidly in developing that kind of a service. I think that libraries will use that. I think a lot of other kinds of memory organizations will use that, and I think a whole lot of organizations beyond libraries will use that. There's, of course, the notion of doing computing in compute clouds that have this similar kind of geographically distributed property. Actually, using those is not entirely trivial. I can understand why public library that's locally hosting systems today might want to have the redundancy and other advantages of being able to run those systems in a sort of a backed up and managed kind of a way outside their organization. rather than worrying about can they adequately provide, you know, continuity of power and HVAC and everything else to their local institutional computer room. But I think that those migrations are still not as simple to do as they're made out to be in many cases. In universities, I think that, you know, in most cases, in terms of compute clouds, what the university library would do would be to go with the overall university strategy for dispersing computing and for providing backup to critical computational applications. The other piece I would say about both storage and computing that makes the cloud attractive for certain kinds of applications is the ability to basically scale up and down on demand. So if you suddenly need a huge amount of computational capability, think about, you know, I don't know, being an online florist in the couple days before Mother's Day or Valentine's Day, or retailers in the Christmas rush, or, you know, you pick it. Those kinds of things where you have to deal with huge demand spikes, being able to make it someone else's problem to manage the capacity in order to support those spikes is attractive. Now, you don't get that for free. I mean, it's more expensive to buy the same number of cycles on a continued basis in the cloud today than it is to buy them yourself locally. You are paying a bit of a premium for that ability to scale up and down. It's just that because the computational providers can pool lots of demand that has spikes at different times, they get an economy out of it that you can't exploit. Similar sorts of advantages accrue to people in startup mode who don't necessarily have a lot of capital to buy computational or storage capacity as they're just starting their business. I've tried to look around a bit, both in the university settings and in the library setting, for those kinds of computational and storage spikes, and I've only really identified them in fairly limited settings. Certainly, in disaster recovery scenarios, you may have some very big spikes for applications that are off-site. That's to be expected. You might have a few modest spikes for things like registration, but relative to the kind of, you know, base level of computing in use at a typical university, I don't really think it's that massive a spike up. The places where you get big demand spikes, I believe, are predominantly in research computing, where someone may suddenly need a whole lot of capacity to do something with a data stream or carry out some piece of analysis or data mining or something. Conceivably, you can see data spikes associated with that. But those aren't areas where, at least today, libraries are terrifically active by and large. I suppose I can imagine situations as libraries support more data mining kinds of applications where it might be fruitful to be able to bring on-demand computation to bear in ways that it's not being done today, but that's still pretty speculative. The other piece of this, of course, is all of the wonderful software services that the cloud hosts, you know, everything from something like Flickr Commons, all the way through backup services or services for actually, you know, running applications of various specific kinds. And there I think that, you know, libraries, just like everybody else, will end up making programmatic use of some of those services. But in many cases, I wonder if it won't be supplementary. I think that there's a very strong tendency on the part of the consumer public still to confuse what are essentially access sites, Flickr, for example, with strategies for long-term preservation of things. I personally, at least, you know, in today's state of the art, while if I had a lot of photos, might very well put them out on Flickr as an access and sharing mechanism, I'd be pretty nervous about saying, yeah, and that's my only copy. And having my only copy in Flickr doesn't to me feel like a very comprehensive long-term preservation strategy, at least right now. I think that, you know, as I say, there's still a lot of confusion in the consumer sector about the roles of these services for access or use versus preservation. I hope that libraries are already more sophisticated about that, and I know that some of them are. But I do worry about some of the, particularly the smaller libraries, getting drawn into that that confusion. So those are at least a few thoughts on where I see some of the cloud developments fitting in. I do think that particularly some of these developments in storage clouds are extremely interesting, and I'm watching the Dura Cloud work quite closely.
Thanks, Cliff. We just have a few more minutes, and I don't see other questions, so would you like to give a quick plug for our JISC CNI conference this summer?
Yes, I can do that, but before I do that, I'm going to just take one moment and sort of give you know, one more poll for questions or comments out there, out there among the people on the call.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
I'm judging by the silence here, the virtual silence here, that people actually want to hear a plug for the JISC CNI meeting. So I'll do that briefly. CNI has been doing these joint meetings with the Joint Information Systems Committee in the UK for about 15 years now, every other year, where we bring some people from the US and the UK together to look at parallel developments of common interest. Often there's a great deal we can learn from each other, and yet somehow, even though we share a more or less common language, it seems to be really hard to transfer learning from one side of the world to the other here. So that's part of what these meetings are about. Another part is really getting people an opportunity to meet colleagues from across the Atlantic and laying the groundwork, hopefully, for future collaborations. So we're just starting to finalize some of the details of this meeting now. It will be in Edinburgh on the 1st and 2nd of July. We will have some keynotes dealing with data sharing policies and how that's playing out among funders and science agencies and scholars themselves. We're going to have Greg Jackson from EDUCAUSE do one of the featured breakouts on some of the developments that he's tracking. We've got some work in preservation that we're going to highlight. It's really starting to come together, I think, quite well, and we're probably about a month out from being able to share a final program on that with folks. But I do think that there's going to be a lot of very interesting material in there, with a strong thread dealing with e-research, data sharing, and the ramifications of those kinds of activities. But certainly far from being, limited to those topics, there's quite a lot of other things that we'll be covering as well. So you'll want to keep your eyes open, I think, for the announcement on that. Historically, it has certainly, for obvious reasons, had, since we generally hold it in the UK, had heavier attendance from the UK than the US. But I think it's a great opportunity to get caught up on some of the very good work that they're doing over there. As things go forward. So those are a few things that I can mention at this point about the upcoming JISC CNI meeting, and I will keep everybody updated on that. I see us, I guess we are getting towards the end of our time. Is there a last question or comment out there before I sign off for the afternoon?
There are no further questions on the queue.
All right. Well, if not, I think I know Joan's got a couple more that were emailed in, but I think we're close enough to time that we'll save those for next time. And let me just, remind you too that we do make audio files of these available after the sessions. So if there are issues that come up, do email them in as questions, just as you think of them going along. And even if you can't make the call, you can always refer to them through the audio recordings later. So with that, thanks everybody for joining us, and I hope I'll see many of you in Baltimore in just a few weeks now. And I wish you all a great day. Thanks.